from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. What was the first rock and roll song? It's a perennial debate among music historians. Some experts point to Rocket 88, first recorded in 1951.
You heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88.
And that song was credited to Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats, but in his ambitious new book, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, Ed Ward traces the roots of rock and roll all the way back to the 1920s, to vaudeville and traveling medicine shows. We'll talk to Ward, the rock and roll historian of NPR's Fresh Air, about the book, and we'll take your questions about rock history. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
That, of course, is the King, Elvis Presley, singing You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. And if you're a rock aficionado, well, even if you're not a rock aficionado, you may know that Big Mama Thornton did the song 3 years earlier. We're going to find out all about rock and roll in this hour and its history. Rock and roll historian for NPR's Fresh Air is Ed Ward. He has published a new book. It's called The History of Rock and Roll. It's the first volume. Starts in 1920, actually starts before then, and goes through 1963, and he argues that rock and roll began with neither Elvis Presley nor, for that matter, Beatlemania. Instead, he weaves together the individual stories of 900-plus lesser-known musicians and producers, many of them African-American, who shaped the origin and the trajectory of rock and roll. And we welcome Ed Ward to the Forum program. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to actually begin by talking about some of these roots because it's extraordinary how far back you go. I mean, it says 1920, but you go back even to the 19th century, work songs and chain gang songs and songs sung in church and the birth of the blues in the South, where they nursed it, rehearsed it. A lot of people really don't think of rock and roll as going back that far, but these are the real roots.
Well, I mean, it's in this part of the story, it's pretty much American music. And when it was decided to call a certain flavor of American music rock and roll is pretty much irrelevant. The idea is that there was commercially produced music. Excuse me. I am suffering from cedar fever, a wonderful Texas affliction. When it was decided to call a particular flavor of American music rock and roll, there was a music business up and running, and there were a lot of musics out there, some of which began to coalesce around this sort of teenage center.
Well, and yet, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, and Alan Freed supposedly gave the name to rock and roll, but that's disputable. And thank you, by the way, for mentioning one of my heroes, Bill Randall, who, as you say in the book, really, boy, you got it bad, don't you?
Yeah.
I really understood rock and roll. He really got it. I have to agree with you on that. But then you mentioned in the book, when I was growing up in Cleveland, I was going to say G by the Crows was supposed to be the first rock and roll hit. And then you say in the book in one chapter, well, rock and roll was born in 1955, maybe. And maybe it was 1951 with what we heard earlier with the Billboard, Rocket 88. There are a lot of different interpretations, and maybe ultimately, in fact, Chuck Berry, I think you say in the book, invented the idea. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah, maybe it doesn't. You don't, you know, there's no, it's not like sonata allegro form. There's no rules you have to fulfill in order to be rock and roll.
Well, indeed.
It's an attitude, you know.
And it's also, you know, I guess really you think about the prominence of rock and roll. When it hit the film Blackboard Jungle with Bill Haley and the Comets, I think that was sort of major impact, wasn't it, in terms of really launching?
Oh, yeah. It was, well, this was a story about bad kids and although Haley was older than his audience, and although he didn't really look like a bad kid, and he wasn't a bad kid, he was still the combination of the two, that here are these kids having this riot in the classroom, and that the music starts off the film. It just, there was a synergy there between the two of them. I have this wonderful description that I found of Ian Dury, who was a British artist and, excuse me, rock and roll star later in the 80s, talking about his childhood. And they went to the theater, and the minute Rock Around the Clock came on, they started, you know, taking knives and destroying the seats and throwing things at the screen and just generally going ape. So it's, you know, it's the attitude.
Rock and roll has always been an attitude. And when we look for the roots, we're looking in the different regions, the South, the West. In fact, I thought maybe our listeners could hear one of the early examples of what we call rock and roll, all attitude notwithstanding. And it's Bob Willis doing a song called Ida Red, Bob Willis and the Texas Playboys.
Bob Wills, excuse me.
Yeah.
And this is important because this is the song Chuck Berry adapted for Maybelline.
Exactly. Let's hear. Well, there is that Maybelline, Why Can't You Be True in that, isn't there? You get a lot of the lineage of rock and roll when you read your book. You find out what influenced what and who influenced whom. And what about that one besides Chuck Berry?
Well, I mean, for Chuck Berry, you just add what we're listening to now. You add some Louis Jordan with his you know, rapid-fire jive delivery, and you've got Chuck Berry.
Well, also, you know, let's hear something else from this earlier phase. This is what's called a Jump Blues song. This is 1947. It's Winona Harris, and I mention, again, the lineage here because a lot of people, we'll talk about Elvis, of course, but a lot of people associate Elvis just doing what black people were doing all along, but as Tom Parker said, getting a white boy to sing that black music. And he was a teen, and he was listening. He was in Tupelo and going to Miss before he went to Memphis and heard this particular Jump Blues song. Let's hear a bit of it.
Have you heard the news? Everybody's going to rock tonight. Going to hold my baby tight as I can. Tonight she'll know I'm a mighty man. Have you heard the news? They're good at rocking tonight. So meet me in the alley behind the barn. Don't be afraid, I'll do you no harm. Baby, bring my rocking shoes, cause tonight I'm gonna rock away all my blues.
Talk about attitude, Ed Ward. I mean, all these... many people were concerned about rock and roll was going to spoil our youth. It was a menace. You get some of that, as you alluded to, in Bill Haley and the Comets and Blackboard Jungle. But when you hear a song like that and how tight I'm going to hold my baby tonight, I mean, this is new territory. This is threatening to many people.
Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't new territory, but the fact that it was eagerly, I don't know, accepted by a certain...
Yeah.
Part of teenage society was new. Previously, songs like this were aimed at adults. And in fact, I would say that most of Winona Harris's sales were to black adults in urban situations. But the fact that teenagers suddenly got interested in dirty records is what I think... Well, excuse me. You know, dirty records and the irresistible sound. I mean, that record just jumps out of its grooves.
It's actually a pretty exciting record to listen to, and you've just made that sense now of that distinction between what for a long time was considered black music and wasn't supposed to be in the so-called mainstream. Like I said, Elvis was considered, you know, a white boy who could sing black-type music, but you write about Mamie Smith, and you write about her walking into Ola Records. That's quite a story in New York City, and it really brings black music into the mainstream.
Well, yeah, I mean, black music was part of the mainstream by the time Wynonie Harris came around, but only the more respectable end of it, you know, jazz. And a lot of what happened after Mamie Smith made blues so acceptable was very much in the direction of jazz. I mean, in the orthodox American music history, Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and so forth, they weren't thought of so much as blues singers as they were jazz singers, early jazz singers in the lineage that leads to Billie Holiday and so forth.
Yeah, you write about the Stroll and Duke Ellington and Nat King Cole and the Muddy Waters. I mean, there's a whole sense of a lineage of popular acceptance of black
singers.
Those
are all different sorts of music, I mean.
But it really, I mean, you know, we're talking about a kind of barrier that was broken in terms of popular music and blacks getting into rock and roll and being part of the mainstream of rock and roll. I mean, figures like Little Richard and James Brown or Ray Charles.
Well that's, again, that's different. You know, Richard was a pure rock and roll star. He was definitely of the youth. But some of those other people, Ray Charles started out sounding like Charles Brown, who was a very sophisticated blues singer, and he did a very bad job of sounding like Charles Brown, and it wasn't until he found his actual voice, which was gospel, that he broke through. And, you know, there were still lots of, you know, you still had Billy Eckstine and so forth on the radio back then, very, very conventional sorts of sounds.
And let's talk about actually how rock and roll continued to evolve. I want to hear another cut here and get you to talk about it. Maybe you can set it up for it. It's a cut from called Don't Be Ashamed to Call My Name by the Royals back in 1958.
That's the Five Royals, not the Royals. There was a big lawsuit about that. The Royals became Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, who were also making dirty black records. But the Five Royals were a gospel group who went secular. And then they also had this magnificent guitar player who was also their chief songwriter, Loman Pauling. So this is sort of a proto-soul record.
And a B-side, wasn't it? Dedicated?
Wait, you're playing Don't Be Shamed, right?
Yeah, but it was a B-side. I mean, these are 45s.
It probably was.
On two different sides.
I don't have the materials in front of me.
Yeah, I don't want to get too obscure here.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Let's hear it.
So, baby, now, don't be ashamed to call my name. 'Cause I'm going to tell it like it is. 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 So, baby, now.
We're talking with Ed Ward. He's the author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. He's rock and roll historian for NPR's Fresh Air and also contributed to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and countless music magazines. And I'd like to just segue from the Royals to the Five Royals, to a song that many of you probably recognize by Dion DiMucci, Dion and the Belmonts. And the reason I'm segueing here also is the fact that we're talking about kind of high spots here in many ways, or moments of serious recognition of different artists. I wonder why was a breakthrough for a white harmony group, just as I suppose you could say, and this is right out of Ed Ward's book, it was tough for a lot of black groups, But Dion might have been a contender. The Belmonts broke up after a while, then they came back together. Let's hear a little bit of I Wonder Why.
No, I love you like I do. No, I do.
Different kind of music in some ways, Ed Ward, with Dion?
Well, yes, but what they're doing here is taking techniques that were widespread in black vocal music and making their own take on it. This is absolutely not a copy of anybody. You know, there are lots of white vocal groups at this point making cover versions of black songs and usually doing better with them. In terms of sales, because they were, you know, much more acceptable to radio programmers. You know, there was the Penguins did Earth Angel, and then they got covered by some white group that wound up doing better with it. But Dion and the Belmonts, they understood the element, the essence of vocal music, and that's what you hear there.
Well, kind of a more gospel song, but I was thinking in reading your book, the Orioles did Crying in the Chapel, and then Elvis did it after that. And let's talk about Elvis for a moment before we go on to some other things historically. You know, many people, as I said, associate Elvis with the extraordinary entrepreneur Colonel Tom Parker, who said, if I can find a white boy who could sing black, I'm going to make a fortune.
That wasn't Colonel Tom. That was Sam Phillips, who was the head of Sun Records, who was a really important figure in merging black and white.
You know, Tom Parker,
Andreas van Huyck, he was a Dutch refugee who reinvented himself in the United States and knew only how to make money. He had no aesthetic input into Elvis at all.
No, Sam Phillips was the record maker, and you go into the whole record industry here in ways that are really eye-opening. Also, take us back to jukeboxes and how music evolved for teens on radio and how Dick Clark in Philadelphia had American Bandstand. I mean, you've got the whole picture here. I mentioned Tom Parker because he was often associated with, you know, essentially galvanizing Elvis as a moneymaker, and whether it was Sam Phillips or Tom Parker who originally made that statement, the real key to Elvis and launching his career was a woman named Marion Kiesker, which a lot of people don't know about.
Right. She was Sam's second in command, and she was in the studio when Elvis came by to make that record for his mother. But she had good ears, and she wrote something on the tape box, you know, that maybe Sam would like to hear this at some point.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, and then there was a day when Sam was looking, he had a song that he was absolutely sure was a hit, and he was looking for somebody to record it, and Marion went, "How about that kid?" And so they had him in to give give it a shot, and he failed miserably. it was not a very good song from all I've heard.
Yeah, and likewise, but that was where things began. He said to Marion Kiesker, she said, "What do you sing?" He said, "I sing Hillbilly."
No, she said, "Yeah, do you sing Hillbilly?" He says, I sing all kinds."
Ah, okay. I'm glad we got on the record on that. We're talking about kind of a parallel development. What's going on in rock and roll is also there's development, as you point out, in blues and in swing and in country and in ragtime, too.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
All these things are going on in a parallel way. I mean, we're talking about the history of rock and roll, but there's a parallel development in blues and in ragtime and in swing, moving forward and moving more into the mainstream, moving more popular.
Well, I don't know. Ragtime was pretty much a spent force by the time the book starts. I, I don't really understand where you're.
Well, I was thinking about Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin, of course, is before what we're talking about now. But I'm thinking just that there were other kinds of music that merged, and they were all in some way synchronous.
But there were current popular musics. One thing that was happening was that the electric guitar, the technology of the electric guitar, was springing up all kinds of new sounds, beginning with Muddy Waters and crew in Chicago. But that wasn't really moving towards the mainstream. Blues, electric guitar blues records tended to be novelties at this point, and very few of them broke into the mainstream. But they were definitely, you know, they were out there for people to listen to. There were advances in country music, largely spurred by the success of Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins. The kind of more rhythmic, more rocking country sounds became a factor in Nashville, and Nashville had to cope with that. And part of the way Nashville coped with it was by coming up with their own form of pop singers, starting with for instance, Roy Orbison. I think they probably would have done that to Buddy Holly had he lived.
Yeah, I didn't know until I read your book that Orbison and Pat Boone were classmates. You learned a lot from this book along those lines. But when you talk about let me move to another realm of music. Surf music was moving along, and you write about it. And at the same time, we had more records coming out with a new sound that you describe as brighter and more aggressive. And pop, you have the Crystals, Then He Kissed Me. Let's hear that. Talking again with Ed Ward, his first volume of The History of Rock and Roll is out and available. It's between 1920 and 1963. And Then He Kissed Me, like Ed Ward says in his book, came along with all this new sound, brighter and more aggressive. Trini Lopez rocking up Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer, reviving La Bamba, Dion singing about Donna the Prima Donna, R&B, not only had James Brown, Live at the Apollo album, selling almost like a single throughout the summer, but yeah, Charlie and Inez Fox's Odd But Catchy Mockingbird. In other words, there are so many of these places where suddenly you have almost a proliferation of music. And we're going to talk about it more with Ed Ward and with you. In fact, we invite your participation in the program. I'd like to hear from you, thoughts about rock and roll and its history. You can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED4. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Ed Ward about the history of rock and roll, the origins of rock and roll, and the various periods and eras of rock and roll, really. His History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, is out. It takes us from 1920 to 1963, as I said earlier. Actually, takes us even before 1920. And we want to hear from you. If you have some thoughts about great rock music, if you have questions about rock music, by all means, feel free to join the program. We invite you to do that now. You can do that by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum at kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum, or you can go to our Facebook page. Many ways you can join the program with your questions or your comments. I'd like to hear from listeners about what they think the great rock and roll music is of their youth, or for that matter, now, although this book takes us up to 63 and takes us up to really the British invasion and the Beatles and all of that. early Dylan and so forth. You know, when you mentioned Carl Perkins, Edward, I was reminded of the fact that there were originally two versions of Blue Suede Shoes, which was a monster hit with, I believe, Heartbreak Hotel on the other side. And the reality was that there were many records that came out of which there were two versions. You mentioned, for example, Shaboom, which was a big hit back in the 50s, done by the Chords and the Crew Cuts. And then we have, you know, later versions. We heard I'm Walking earlier by Fats Domino, and then Ricky Nelson did it. So there's, it seems to me, now much more of the kind of lineage that you can trace, different versions coming out and so forth. But in the early stage of rock and roll, what they call on Sirius Radio the birth of rock and roll, there were often two groups or two individuals doing the same song almost simultaneously.
Well, not really. I mean, in almost every single case that you mentioned there, it's a question of a cynical usurpation of the original black record by more easily saleable white people. This is why one of the reasons Maybelline is so important is that they tried. There were seven or eight different cover versions that came out almost immediately after Chuck Berry's, and none of them sold a single record. You know, they, as far as the charts were concerned, they didn't exist. And as far as radio was concerned, they didn't exist because this was something that was not copyable. And you can hear this with Pat Boone's covers of Little Richard. I can't think of two people more radically different from each other. And you can sure hear it in the Wax.
Let me hear from some of our listeners. And again, you're feel free to join us toll free at 866-733-6786. Here's Milton. Milton, you're on the air.
Hello. Great segment. Well, as the Five Royales demonstrated, at first the tenor sax was the lead instrument. How did it evolve to being the electric guitar? And secondly, I'd like Ed to talk about the classic Sun Sessions.
Well, as far as the guitar, that is a relic of the gospel world. There was, you know, the classic gospel group is a certain number of singers, usually five, and then you would have a piano, an organ, and a guitar. The guitar was usually very genteel, strummed, you know, just as a way of keeping everybody in tune so they could hear the various notes in the chord. But Pauling had a more radical vision of what he could do with the guitar, and apparently this was also accompanied by onstage antics of the guys jumping through each other's arms and you know, Lohman wearing his guitar way, way down. And I don't think he did the duck walk the way Chuck Berry did, but Chuck Berry did see him and I think was inspired to invent that duck walk from Lohman Pauling's antics on stage.
Boy, talk about annex.
Sun Sessions. What?
No, I say talk about annex. You go into the annex of Chuck Berry here in the book in some to some degree. I mean, so he was always in trouble and couldn't stay out of trouble.
Well, that wasn't on stage.
No, I just had to bring that in here. It was.
But to the other part of Milton's question, the Sun Sessions. I mean, I can't comment on that. There, I have several box sets from Bear Family that deal with just individual performers' sessions for Sun, including the complete Jerry Lee Lewis tapes. What was happening? Especially once Sam Phillips realized that he had serious competition for the black artists, but no competition whatever for these weirdo rockabilly types who were showing up. He just opened the floodgates, and there's so many obscure Sun rockabillies in there that it would take a book. It would take an afternoon to even scratch the surface.
Maybe after volume two, you can do that, Ed. Here's a listener who asks, why did the Mississippi Delta region produce so many important musicians? Did Charlie Patton invent the Delta blues?
Well, no. Charlie Patton wasn't primarily a blues singer. He was a songster. But the reason the Delta is so prominent in musical history is that it was the start of the journey north. A lot of black musicians were fed up with Mississippi. They'd go up to the big city, which is Memphis, and then they'd find that Memphis wasn't doing them well, and then they would take a real gamble and take the train up to Chicago. So you had three different centers of energy, one primarily acoustic music, another mixed acoustic and electric music, and finally in Chicago, the flowering of the Delta blues transmogrified by technology into the Chicago blues.
Again, we're talking to Ed Ward, author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1. And here is Jeffrey. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I was very interested to hear your author talk about the Five Royales, because I have a radio program. I play mostly rhythm and blues out here in Point Reyes. And doing research for my show, I'm a big fan of Otis Redding, Booker T, and the MGs as backup band. And I found out that the Five Royales were a huge influence on the Booker T and the MGs when they were young and forming their music.
Steve Cropper in particular, the guitar player in the MGs. I mean, he put out a tribute record to the Five Royales recently because he couldn't believe they hadn't been paid attention to.
I know. I heard one song. I play about four or five of their songs now, and one of the Come on and Love Me. And it's like, it's very gospely, very bluesy, very fun song. But the guy's like, you know, if you don't love me, I'm going to jump up a building. I'm going to lay my head on the railroad track. But it works. You know, it doesn't come off more. But anyway, they were great. So glad to discover
them. That's a gospel song. Lord, come on and save me.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't songwriting magic to transform some of those.
Yeah, but lay my head on a railroad track, that's right out of Trouble in Mind, if you remember that old.
You're taking, you know, boilerplate lyrics and just sort of soldering them onto a gospel song.
And
well,
Jeffrey,
Charles,
I'm sorry.
Ray Charles did a lot of that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I got a woman, I got a savior. Gospel songs that everybody knew.
Right.
So it was kind of shocking. I mean, that's why Sam Cooke got in so much trouble, because he crossed a border after becoming a star in gospel.
Yeah, let me put it.
Ray Charles was never a gospel star. He was just a guy who went to church.
Good.
Sam Cooke's group, the Soul Stirrers, they were the leading gospel group at the time. They were the most popular when Sam crossed over and did You Send Me.
Yeah, I want to put a plug in for John Antonelli's movie about Sam Cooke, which we featured here on Forum, which is a really excellent movie. And let me thank Jeffrey for the call. We'll go to more calls in a moment. I want to go to more music, though. I think, you know, we're talking about, in fact, I'm looking at a comment here from a listener who says, I'm shocked by the divisions driven by commercial genre categorization. Maybe I'm more open because I was born in Cleveland and grew up listening to everything in the white suburbs of Detroit in the 80s, but I'm troubled by the growing split between hip-hop as black music and rock and roll being for whites. Can you speak more to why and how this happened? It seems to have been in the 70s after the death of Hendrix and with the rise of soul and funk. Well, this takes us into your second volume, but I do want to get...
Right. Yeah. No, I mean... This is one of the problems of quote unquote scientific marketing, which is one of the things that almost destroyed rock and roll in the 70s, in that fragmenting the audience made it a lot easier to sell to the audience. And I am going to talk about this a lot in volume two.
I want to hear it.
No, it is the segregation. The fact that rock and roll broke down segregation, that a lot of, at least when I was a kid, we didn't know these people were black, some of them, and we didn't know some of them weren't black. it was rock and roll. You either liked it or you didn't. And we did. But then things got really, I don't know, a little
complicated,
bit creepy, as after the Beatles, you know, the idea that you could turn on an AM station that played top 40 and you could hear soul music, you could hear some of the poppier country stuff, you could hear, you know, kids with guitars, you could hear all kinds of stuff, and then suddenly you couldn't.
Well, I thought we'd hear some more music as we kind of trace rock and roll right up to 63, where Ed's first volume ends. I selected some samples of some music that I think really made a major impact, and I thought we'd hear one that I remember seeing these kids on television. They were kids off the street, but they were dressed like Ivy League kids with sweaters and so forth. And they were black kids, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. Let's hear a little of Why Do Fools Fall in Love. Well, needless to say, Edward, a monster hit, and they were teenagers. They were black kids, and they were very well
advertised.
Yeah, and
they were also, I don't know if you can say racially mixed, but some of them were Puerto Rican and some of them were black. So they were, you know, the voice of East Harlem, as it were.
And then I wanted to hear, you're down, Ed is with us from Texas this morning. I wanted to, like, mix a number of cuts here. I wanted to have someone who's very important to me personally was Buddy Holly, and it was almost a kind of rockabilly or hillbilly song. The Everly Brothers, they were, suddenly you had these groups that were really doing music that was almost indigenous in many ways, and later on we heard a James Taylor version of this song. Let's hear a little of Every Day.
Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day it's getting faster. Everyone said go ahead and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way.
This is Buddy Holly, who, of course, was with the Crickets for a number of years and died with Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens in a plane crash. That's the song, to some extent, or gave catalyst to the song by Don McLean. Let me go to more of your calls. We'll intersperse some music here, and we'll get Chris on the air with us. Chris, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I just wanted to get a comment from the speaker. I have an uncle who lives in the Time Warp. When we were at his house, he had the television program Sha Na Na. For him, great rock and roll music died with the British invasion. I'm not of that same opinion, but when I do listen to British rock, it sort of distorts the sound to get its own effect. What comments do you have on the British invasion in terms of being the end of what we saw in American rock and roll?
Let me ask Ed first. Ed, I'm sorry. When did the British invasion officially start? Was it Dave Clark 5?
No, it was 1963 when Capitol Records. One of the things that comes at the end of the book is that on December 26, 1963, Capitol Records finally picked up the option that they'd refused to exercise to put out the Beatles in the United States, and they put out I Want to Hold Your Hand, I think as a way of trying to get EMI in Britain to shut up about these idiots with the weird hair. And of course, there were lots of other groups in Britain, and when the Beatles did prove to be successful, they all had record contracts. Everybody in America wanted a British group, and so they quote-unquote invaded. But you know, it was yet another flavor of rock and roll. Nothing ended at all. I mean, after the British or during the British invasion was the flowering of some of the very greatest Motown records, was the beginning of some of the great Southern soul records on Stax and Gold Wax records. It was a really golden period of country music. I don't think anything ended. Only somebody who's got their, you know, head in the sand would believe that.
Well, it's funny because even that language, British Invasion, I can remember being used before the Beatles when the Rolling Stones and Dave Clark 5 and groups like that were making an impact. But
They weren't making an impact because none of them had records out in the United States. Nobody had ever heard of them.
Well, they were making it across the pond. I mean, certainly they were making an impact there. And then the invasion came soon after. They had come into popularity. I wanted to actually, you mentioned Motown. I wanted to hear a little bit of Motown, just a sampling of that, and then maybe we can hear I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles.
And then she said, just because you become a young man now, it's still some
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Many thought Smokey Robinson was really the best poet to come out of lyric writing of all time. You still get, in America at least, you still hear that. And since Ed mentioned the Beatles and I Want to Hold Your Hand, here's a little sampling of that. Talking Ed Ward, author of The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963, and I'm going to go to more of your calls shortly. Let me go to a listener comment here who writes, don't forget Arthur Big Boy Crudup, whose Rock Me Mama is another candidate for first rock and roll song, and whose That's All Right Mama was covered by Elvis, and I would like to mention Louis Jordan, whose Boogie Woogie records were crossover hits in the late 1940s. Ed Ward?
Yeah, well, as far as Louis Jordan's concerned, he's not about to be forgotten. He sold millions of records. He made films starring himself and his band. He's a very important predecessor to rhythm and blues, which didn't really get codified until after the war. As far as Big Boy Crudup, I'm sorry. He is not that important a figure. He was lucky that Elvis liked his record, and he was very lucky that Elvis saw to it that RCA Victor treated him very, very well in his later years. But I find his work to be incredibly repetitive and not very interesting.
Some more comments, since we're mentioning Louis Jordan. Here's Alfred, who writes, as teenagers in the 40s and 50s, we rocked to Louis Jordan, Big Mama Willie Mae Thornton, Boogie Woogie by Pinetop Smith, Albert Ammons, Jay McShann, and on. The seminal music that began the English invasion with the Rolling Stones was Chess Brothers' Electric Mud, featuring Muddy Waters transposing his classic hits into a jazzy off-key mode. And Judd writes, so much history. My parents' 78 RPM collection had Louis Jordan's Ain't Nobody In Here But Us Chickens, Bill Doggett's Honky Tonk Parts 1 and 2, Ruth Brown, and on. My first 45 RPM was Fats Domino's Blueberry Hill, but the Coasters were my main group. No airplay for the Midnighters due to blue lyrics. And Kevin says, I would, of course, go a step further regarding rock and roll's influences. Some are willing to speak to an African-American connection in rock music. However, when we study the compositional and structural aspects of various forms like blues, gospel, jazz, rock, etc., we see that the nature of these styles exist in what we know as call and response. Ed Ward.
Well, that very much a part of the African-American thing, both in the work song area and in the church. Call and response is a very important thing there. And it did form a great deal of the template for vocal group music in particular, because a lot of it came out of gospel.
And here's Patrick, who writes, I'd like to hear Ed expound upon the parallel development of country and rock and roll, as they are virtually inseparable as far back as Jimmy Rogers. That's not the Jimmy Rogers of Honeycomb, by the way, playing blues fills over yodeling. And then enter Hank Williams and Johnny Cash, becoming effectively modern icons to many rock musicians.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on an individual basis, it's really impossible to say this is a country record or this is a rock and roll record. For somebody like Cash, he was so not typical of anything in country music. Hank Williams, too, he revolutionized the writing of lyrics to take them away from a very generalized sentimental thing into a very blues directed, you know, this is me. I have pain. This is my problem. My problem is you. And such directness was shocking to Nashville, and it woke them up out of about a 30-year coma of writing sentimental glop.
And let me go to more of your calls. Let's go to Pico next. Pico, you're on the air.
It isn't Pico. It's Peter Clarkie. Okay. Former studio drummer of Apple Records. Listen, first of all, the second most important word, the second word is the most important one, roll. You've played big band swing, you've played all kinds of, it's not, that isn't it, it's roll. Until it rolls, until Richard Penniman comes along and makes it roll, and he borrowed it from Escorita, but that's beside the point. Until he does that, and then Chuck Berry uses his keyboard player, tunes and writes the most amazing lyrics, rock and roll doesn't take off because it doesn't roll. The first time I ever heard anyone actually roll something was Hoagy Carmichael's Piano Piece in the middle of Don't Fence Me In. I mean, you're so far off the mark. You're just going backwards and backwards and backwards. You want to talk about blues, you want to go back to Jimmy Rogers, because there's no American authentic blues until Jimmy Rogers comes along. And the reason for that is quite simple. American blacks realized they could actually make a living on their own doing whatever they wanted to do in 1928.
You want to respond, Ed?
Jesus. I mean, so this is... Hold on
a second. We'll come back to you. Let me go to Ed Ward first. Go ahead.
I have no idea what he's attempting to say here. The role is very important to me personally. And believe me, when we get to the end of the 60s and into the 70s, the fact that it's now called rock music and that the roll has been given a far secondary place, that's very important, and I intend to write a good deal about that next time. As far as, you know, what he's saying about Jimmy Rogers and blues music, I didn't get that at all. I'm sorry.
You get usually this kind of passion from readers or people who hear you.
Well, he's
radio?
Passionate, all right. There's no question about that.
People do get passionate about this music. Let me actually thank him for the call and go to more of your calls. Heather joins us next. Heather, you're on the air.
Good morning. I was calling to get maybe a few of your thoughts on the influence of jug band music, particularly the likes of like the Memphis Jug Band, on the development of rock music. It seems like there's a whole lot of influence across a lot of different artists, and I just wanted to hear your take on that history.
Well, jug band music was hokum music. It was a division of hokum music, this kind of comedic black music that was very popular with white people, particularly in Memphis and Louisville and, you know, large southern cities. But its rediscovery by the folk kids in the beginning in the 1960s was very, very important, particularly because a lot of the folkies who were playing jug band music evolved into rock musicians later on. But that's also for the second book. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't until the rediscovery of this music by a new generation that it really became influential, and you really wouldn't have had people like, for instance, the Lovin' Spoonful, who even did a song called Jug Band Music, which wasn't anything like jug band music.
Huh.
That's when the influence really came on, and, you know, Walk Right In, by, what was that, the Rooftop Singers,
right,
who were good enough to pay royalties to Gus Cannon, who wrote the song back in Memphis in the 1930s.
Actually, speaking
but,
of...
That's later on.
Speaking of royalties, there was some criticism of your book, but he said... it's easy through all the great storytelling that Ward gives us to miss questionable assertions, like suggesting that Atlantic Records founder Ahmet Erdogan, an incomparable record maker and talent scout, but a notorious royalty cheat, eschewed the common industry practice of denying artists and songwriters their due.
Well, I don't know what exactly the charges against Ahmet Erdogan were or are, but... there were common practices, and yes, some of these people could have used lawyers, and yes, Ray Charles, for instance, did use lawyers, and he was getting paid very, very nicely, especially after he left Atlantic. But the reason he left Atlantic was as much artistic as it was a business decision. I don't want to even get into the fact that there was nothing in popular music culture that saw that made it a moral imperative for these record companies to write fair contracts. That wouldn't happen for a long while, and it's a shame, but it's, you know, what happened.
Well, we're going to hear a little more music here. I just want to get a little Bobby Darin in there. Walden Crosetti, who married Alessandra Zuck or Sandra Dee. I remember seeing those names on the original marriage licenses. He was a phenomenon, and there was a movie made, of course, as many of you know, with Kevin Spacey actually doing the singing. We're coming to the end of this hour, and I wanted to go out with a really important song, because I think, Ed Ward, wasn't Chubby Checker's The Twist one of the only records to become a number one hit twice?
Yeah, it was, but it wasn't his song. It was by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters.
No, he was a chicken plucker in Philadelphia. He was not a songwriter, but here it is. We'll go out with a twist. Thank you, Ed Ward. Good to have you on.
Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.